Welcome to the Space Show, Alan.
It's just fantastic to be here. Thank you.
In 1989, both Newsweek and Time magazines marked the Voyager 2 flyby of Neptune with the same headline, The Last Picture Show. And yet, 26 years later, you defied that headline and gave us another picture show. Why did it take a quarter of a century beyond Neptune for us to reach Pluto?
Well, there are a number of reasons for that. I would cite two in particular. One is that it took a long time to sell the idea of going to Pluto. It's an expensive proposition. There are many good proposals for things to do that are much closer to home. And there's a natural human tendency to do things that turn out quicker. And we had to overcome that bias to do a mission to the very far reaches of the solar system. And secondly, after we sold it and built it, it took a decade to fly out there, even as the fastest spacecraft ever launched. It's a long way to go.
And what has been your role on the New Horizons team?
Well, I lead the entire enterprise and have since the first day.
The design of the spacecraft and the way you came up with the idea of getting there, how much of that was yours and how much from the rest of the team?
Well, it's a large team. Over 2,500 people worked on the building of New Horizons and its launch vehicle and its instruments. And, you know, hundreds and hundreds of engineers and hundreds of software people and a big science team and all that. And so my job is largely to be the conductor of the orchestra, but the instruments are making all the music. All those other people did all the real work. I'm simply the principal instigator.
So the engineering and all that sort of thing, it was an aid of supporting the science.
Well, absolutely. The science drives the requirements, and the requirements drive the design of the spacecraft.
Now, as it passed Neptune, Voyager 2 took images of the moon Triton. And for a quarter of a century, I had in my mind those images of Triton as how Pluto might look. And before the New Horizons flyby of Pluto and Charon, how did you visualize these two bodies?
Well, I actually refused to visualize Pluto before the flyby, because I knew that all the first missions to the planets, from the first mission to Mars in 1965, first missions to Mercury and Jupiter and Saturn and so forth, always got it wrong in prediction. So it seemed to me that that was a pretty unbroken record, and it just seemed like a futile exercise. Now, I will say that your mental model of perhaps Pluto like Triton is not a bad one, and many people had that, including in the professional community, because the surface compositions are similar, the sizes are similar, the atmospheric compositions are similar, the internal compositions are similar, and Triton was born where Pluto orbits, in this third zone of the solar system we call the Kuiper Belt. So that's not a bad, if you got to have something in your mind, Triton's a reasonable thing to have. As it turns out, Pluto's got Triton beat just about every way you can think of it. It's a much more interesting planet.
Which leads us to asking, what were some of the unexpected findings about Pluto and Charon?
Well, there are literally dozens, perhaps hundreds, but at the very topmost level, I think the biggest surprises had to do with the diversity of landforms and geomorphologies on the surface, the complexity of the atmosphere, that both the surface and the atmosphere of Pluto rival the complexity of Mars. In fact, sometimes we call Pluto the other red planet. And then finding that Pluto is geologically alive today on a vast scale was counter to conventional scientific wisdom. Because it's a small planet, it's expected that it would have cooled off by now, and its geologic engine would have expired. In fact, that's not correct at all, and it sent shockwaves through the planetary science community when we found flowing glaciers, evidence of frozen lakes and perhaps past tributaries that ran on the surface, massive volcanoes the size of Mauna Loa that were born yesterday geologically on Pluto's surface, and more. So the level of complexity and the level of activity were the two big headlines.
Are the glaciers and, for example, the nitrogen flows on Sputnik Planum, are they still active today or has it switched off?
Sputnik Planitia is active today. We see flow patterns in its surface. There are no craters on it, so we know that it's geologically young. Its activity may even be driven by an internal heat source beneath the ice, beneath the nitrogen.
And where would that heat source come from?
Well, that's a very good question. If I knew, I would be a more successful guy than I am now. It's an open question. There are a number of good ideas, but we don't know if any of them are the right idea that will ultimately prove out. In fact, it's such a complex problem that I really think we have to go back with an orbiter and bring new scientific instruments to bear in order to solve that.
Well, that leads us to one of the questions I thought I'd ask you later on, and that is, if you were given a clean sheet of paper and a blank check, what would a new Pluto mission study? In other words, what's left to know about Pluto and Charon?
Well, you know, we've only scratched the surface. We did the equivalent of the first flybys of Mars and Jupiter, which were followed up by orbiters, and in the case of Mars, landers and then rovers. And we're still studying Mars. In the case of Pluto, the right next step is an orbiter. And that way we can be there to stay and see the temporal changes on the surface and in the atmosphere. We can bring a much broader suite of scientific instrumentation. For example, we'd like to have a mass spectrometer in the atmosphere. We'd like to have radar to penetrate the ices. We'd like to have thermal mappers to see where the activity is generated, and other instrumentation as well. So the orbiter is the right next step, and there are a number of teams, my own included, that have that on the drawing board.
And, of course, most of these questions you would not have been able to ask before New Horizons.
Well, absolutely not, because what we knew about Pluto before the flyby of New Horizons could more or less fit on a single sheet of paper.
Now, when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon, they said,
"Oh, that looks beautiful from here, Neil.
It has a stark beauty all its own. It's like much of the high desert of the United States. It's different, but it's very pretty out here."
It has a stark beauty all its own. And
beautiful view. Isn't that something? Magnificent sight out here. Magnificent desolation.
Magnificent desolation. Now, if you were able to do a Pluto walk, what description might you give of your surroundings?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I've never been asked that. Congratulations. You know, Pluto is so varied across its surface, from mountain ranges to canyons to frozen lake beds to vast glaciers and more, that I think it would depend where you were on the surface. You know, clearly what you would see would be different. It's a very alien world, even more so than the moon, because it's frozen at only 40 kelvins above absolute zero, and the surface materials are very alien. Nitrogen ices, methane ices, you know, basically natural gas, which makes the snow caps on Pluto. But I do believe that one day people will walk there and explore the surface as humans. And if I'm very lucky, the medical profession will make it possible for me to live to see that.
Charon has huge chasms. If you were to land in one of those and look around, what would that be like?
Well, it does have large chasms, the largest of which are many kilometers deep and tens of kilometers wide, and stretch for literally more than 1,000 kilometers in length. Because Charon is a relatively small world, if you're at the bottom in the middle of one of these chasms, you probably wouldn't see the chasm walls, because they're over the curvature, they're over the horizon. So you might not know you were in a chasm.
A bit like Mariner's Ballast on Mars, when, you know, even though it's 9 kilometers deep, if you're there, it would just be on a like being on a level plane.
That's a good analogy, and another good analogy is if you were at the bottom of the Earth's oceans, you wouldn't see the walls on the far sides, because they're just too far away and over the horizon.
In what ways is Charon similar or different from Pluto?
They're very different worlds. They have completely different surface compositions, different internal compositions. Charon is small enough that its internal heat engine did run out very early. And so it has been more or less a relic frozen in time, whereas Pluto continues to be active to this day. they really have very few similarities.
So your imagined or hopeful orbiter, and possibly later, you know, later in time, humans might land, put robot landers down, if not themselves. You'd want a separate mission for Charon and Pluto?
Of course, yeah. In the case of the orbiter, we'll use it to study all the satellites of Pluto, as well as the planet itself. But in the case of human missions, I think that if we flew an expedition out there, that they would certainly want to do more than just do the surface of Pluto after that long trip.
Is there anything remarkable about Pluto's four moons, the other four moons, that's Nix, Hydra, Styx, and Kerberos?
Well, there are quite a number of things that are remarkable about them. They all spin very fast compared to their orbital periods, which is completely unexpected and unlike any of the satellites of the giant planets, for example. They're very highly reflective, and we don't understand how their surfaces remain so bright and fresh, like freshly driven snow over billions of years of attack from radiation and micrometeorite bombardment. They are also very old, and I think that's something that was really a controversy before the exploration by New Horizons. There was a number of scientists in my field in planetary science that thought that perhaps the satellite system was young and recently created, but we've now age-dated those satellites by crater counts and shown that they're old. They're as old as the system.
Because the natural order of things, like, for example, the icy moons of Jupiter and Saturn, is that they darken with age and that you can tell the young craters by the freshly exposed white ice.
That's exactly correct. And so we might have expected that for the surfaces of the four small satellites of Pluto. But what we instead find is that all four of them are as reflective as freshly driven snow.
Now, you're halfway to a Kuiper Belt object called 2014 MU69. Now, what do we know about this object?
Well, the most important thing that we know about MU69 is that it's a relic of the very distant outer solar system that's always been at this distance from the sun in these very cold conditions. So we know it's been in a deep freeze, and it preserves information from the very birth of our solar system. It's the most pristine object that has ever been explored. And we know that it's small, perhaps 30 kilometers across, but that means it's 1,000 times more massive than a comet. So it's an intermediate kind of body between the comets and the small planets like Pluto. And it's going to teach us a lot about how the small planets formed and accreted long ago. Really beyond those facts, and its color, which is reddish, more red even than Pluto, we really don't know very much. But New Horizons will transform that in 17 months' time, on the 1st of January 2019, when we make our flyby.
And what studies will you be making as you fly by?
Well, we're going to be mapping the surface of MU69 in exquisite detail, even higher resolution than Pluto. We're going to be mapping its surface composition also in higher resolution than Pluto. We'll be searching for an atmosphere, searching for satellites and rings. We may even be able to determine its mass, and by combining that with the imagery that will tell us its volume, determine its density and therefore its internal bulk composition.
You won't be passing close enough to be affected by its gravity, though.
Well, that depends on the final flyby distance that we choose, and it's just possible that we can measure that mass by the slight bending of our trajectory, revealed in what's called the Doppler shift of the radio signal.
Is there any prospect that MU69 will be given a proper name? Of course, you didn't discover it. It's up to the discoverers and the International Astronomical Union to do that. But any chance of having a proper name before the flyby?
Well, let me start by saying that we did discover it. It was our team that went looking for targets using the Hubble Space Telescope, targets to fly New Horizons 2. So we made the discovery, and it's ours to name. But our plan, working with NASA, is to have a public naming contest. And you'll hear more about that later this year.
Later when?
This year.
Oh, so we encourage our listeners to be in on that. Now, are there any other possible Kuiper Belt flybys after MU69?
You mean by New Horizons?
By New Horizons, that is, yes.
Yeah, well, we're currently looking for targets, but we are low on fuel, and so we'll have to get lucky to find another within the reach of our remaining fuel supply. We'll see.
Now, en route to MU69, are you doing any useful science?
We're doing a great deal. We carry environmental sensors, plasma and dust sensors that have much more capability than Voyager, which flew through this region in the 1990s. But in addition, we're using the telescopes and cameras on board New Horizons to study 20 to 30 other Kuiper Belt objects in a whole variety of ways that you can't study them from the Earth or even from the Hubble Space Telescope. Because we're there, we're at much closer range, and so we can learn things about their satellite systems and their shapes and their surface properties that no other spacecraft or ground-based observatory can. We've already examined about a dozen, and we have perhaps two dozen more to go.
And you just recently you did the occultation measurements from Argentina.
That's correct. We put on an occultation campaign to study MU69 itself, and that was very successful. We actually had five telescopes that caught the event, and soon we'll be releasing the scientific results.
Well, we look forward to hearing those results.
Well, you'll like it. It's interesting.
Okay. And what's next for Alan Stern?
Well, first was a Kuiper Belt mission to fly, and that's going to last through 2021. I'm also very fortunate to be involved in three other space missions, Rosetta, the Europa Clipper, and a new mission called Lucy that's going to explore the Jovian Trojans. I'm also becoming heavily involved in commercial spaceflight and expect to fly in space on commercial vehicles in the next few years. So it's pretty busy.
Wow. All the best then.
Oh, thank you very much, and thanks for having me on.
Thank you.